I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source. Doing politics by the numbers sounds a little unhuman, oxymoronic maybe, but the digital data whiz kid in Boston City Hall, Dan Coe, makes it intriguing, to say the least. Around a work table just outside Mayor Marty Walsh's office, facing our Cradle of Liberty panel hall, the Dan Coe number crunchers are counting potholes filled and graffiti scrubbed on time. Also, opioid use this year over last, calls to veteran services, car traffic flows from Google, mayoral touchdowns week by week in the 22 wards and 255 precincts of the city.
It's a normalized scoring system. So for each of these metrics, they have a given value every day or week or month. And we take that value, and for some of the metrics, most of them on the sheet actually.
Our guest, Dan Coe, if he had his druthers, would probably be running a big league baseball team the sabermetric way, like Billy Beane of the Oakland A's, who was the Brad Pitt character in the movie Moneyball. For now, Dan Coe is running the city of Boston that way for Mayor Marty Walsh, toting up kids in classrooms and trash collections instead of hits, runs, and errors. But he's also looking way beyond those basics toward a formula or algorithm for everything that a city and its people do. Dan, we're hooked. I got to say, we're skeptical too, but it's a fascinating enterprise you're embarked on. The Yellow Brick Road opens up ahead of us. We're dying to meet the wizard. Tell us what you're doing.
Thank you so much. You know, it's really interesting. The mayor took a step back when he first started and had the mentality that the city of Boston's a $2.8 billion organization. If it were in the private sector, it'd be a Fortune 1000 company. And any private sector organization uses data intensely to help make decisions. But in the public sector, and especially at a city level, virtually no mayors use it. So that was the premise.
Funny little switch here, if I may say. Marty Walsh was elected as the trade union guy from Savin Hill. It was the guy he beat, John Conley, that would have been expected to be the geek and the numbers cruncher. What happened? What happened to Marty? Or would you have been working for John Conley too?
No, absolutely not. When I first met the mayor, actually, which was actually very late after he was elected, he told me that he wanted to be deeply data-driven. He told me he wanted Boston to really embody the first true 21st century American city. Right before we met, he actually went to Mayor Bloomberg's office in New York City. Mayor Bloomberg had done a little bit of this. He had a few data dashboards up, a few data metrics up, not even a dashboard, that he was inspired by. And he said, I want you to help me really blow this out and make this a central part of my administration.
But, of course, he had invented it for the bond market. I mean, the ultimate
exactly
detail guy. I lived close enough to Kevin White so that I could see him walk out of his house every morning. And it was sort of nose to the wind and sort of I can smell what's going on. I'm still hooked on people. Ed Koch in New York used to say, you know, how am I doing? Ray Flynn would say in Boston, how are you doing? Right. But a purely intuitive take. What's the add-on here, really, really, really?
I think that there will nothing that will ever replace the appearance at a community meeting, the shaking of a hand, any of those intangibles that make a mayor great. But the reality is that people care deeply about the things like whether they can drive out of their driveway and not hit a pothole and have to get their car repaired. People care that their streets are clean. People care that their garbage get picked up on time. Using this data that we now have available to us will allow that to happen far better than before. And we think that, therefore, that's a worthy endeavor.
You've got screen after screen in your office and the mayor's. Suggest to people what's on them.
It has a wide range of data. It has everything from the percentage of school buses that arrived on time that morning to a breakdown of every neighborhood of the city of Boston and where the mayor's visited in the past 30 days. So it allows us to have a pretty far-reaching a display of the different metrics that we're measuring in the city that the mayor can look up at any given time and see.
But some of it is not that deep. I mean, you'll have potholes filled on time and
yep.
Of course, it all depends on what's on time, maybe
right.
24 hours. Graffiti, you've got 45 days to satisfy, to score a one on your work. It doesn't seem enough in a way.
So right now, the way we're starting city score is we have a number of different metrics. I believe it's 20 to start. There are things like graffiti on time, and I'm not sure what the service level agreement is there. But in terms of the part one, everything from that to part one crimes in the city of Boston and how they've been trending year over year, right? So for us, you know, there are some areas that in a vacuum may not be that important as the only measure of a city, like graffiti, but there are also, you know, number of housing units approved, which we think is very important. There are also things like part one crime, which we think are very, very critical to a city. But we think that each of these little parts of a city make up a more holistic view of what a city's health is. And so the more factors we can have in that, we think the better.
Isn't it infinite, really, when you throw in, for example, housing values over time, different neighborhoods, single family or whatnot? It's mind-boggling how many measures you have once you start chasing them.
Absolutely there are, and one could argue that it is infinite, and I think the argument that we would make as a city is that it is not holistic, right? That you can have 30 metrics, you can have 100 metrics. It will help you directionally, but at the end of the day, it's your instinct and it's the people that really matter. Much like a baseball player and how a scout will evaluate a player. A player could have really good statistics, but at the end of the day, it's that person's awareness when they're up at the plate that really makes them a special player.
I'm thinking of one of these things that just happened, I think it was on the New Yorker magazine's site online, but they had a simple, not simple, infographic about inequality by subway stop for 15 lines probably through Manhattan, the Bronx, Queens, everything. And it was stunning. What I remember was the differences in income, $100,000 difference in median income between, you know, from one stop to another, so say going from the Upper East Side into Harlem. But I thought immediately, God, what all the things we want to know about Boston on that kind of scale. What are some of your fantasy goals to pull out of the data?
Well, I think what's interesting is that with this push for data, I think people realize, especially inside City Hall, that data needs to be open, it needs to be transparent, and people need to be taking that data and making decisions based off of it. The example you used in the New Yorker, the mayor thought it was a priority when we looked at the BRA to hire a demographer, a full-time demographer, and also hire a full-time data visualization artist. So we have all kinds of data visualizations now. We have one that just came out that shows the city of Boston and the largest minority group in each of those neighborhoods. So it's very, very interesting to see, you know, in Dorchester, what ethnic group makes up the largest of the minority ethnic groups there versus East Boston versus others. And that allows us to have insights that we wouldn't have before. It allows us to deploy services, translation services. When we hand out our pamphlets for the snow, we can make sure that in East Boston, we're making sure we have Spanish pamphlets based on that information. So that's where it can really help people, because the data is meaningless unless we're using it to help people.
Do you remember the scene in The Wire where there's a shift in the management of the schools and teachers, and one of the teachers says, one of them is confused, what the hell are they doing? We call it juking the stats, meaning play with the games. If you're asked to count people drinking beer on the street, you say, well, we don't know about that guy. He's drinking out of a bag. We haven't seen the can. So you can play with all the numbers. And I think one of the lines was in on The Wire, what is juking the stats? It's making robberies into larcenies or making rapes disappear. So many of these numbers are gameable.
Yep. Absolutely. And that's a very big concern we have. There have been examples of police officers in other cities being measured on certain statistics, and therefore they behave based on those statistics. We obviously have not seen that in Boston, nor do we with our amazing police force. But a similar thing we've seen in other cities of teachers, changing test scores because they feel pressure that they're being measured. So what we're sending a message internally, at least, is that this is a guide. This is not how you are going to be judged. We really feel like that's important because it's not all about the numbers. And we don't want to create such a pressure on just the measurement part of it that people feel compelled to game things based solely on what equation is in front of them. The way we've designed CityScore, however, is it's based on targets. It's not based on anything complex. So if you're looking at and it's based on a qualitative vision to start, right? So the mayor says he wants housing for all residents of Boston, regardless of income, right? So then we come up with 53,000 new units of housing by 2030. And then we come up with targets of how much of that is middle income versus affordable versus high income. And that helps us guide the stats in a way that's healthy versus purely gaming system for judgment purposes.
Do you dread the day when there's some sort of, you know, universal rating system and you're being judged every day against Shanghai or Tucson or, you know, you name it, around the world? And you're, you know, you're only 103 this week, Dan, or Boston's slipping, you know, the way we do sports statistics.
Yeah. I mean, a couple of things. I think on the plus side, I think the capitalist in me would say that competition is a good thing. And if other cities are being compared to other cities in a more objective way, and we're known, and that's in the public square, that we'll be incented and motivated to improve our services to get better, to prove that we're on par or better than that other city. I think the pessimist in me, though, would say that we have to be careful about how we're judging things and saying that we're purely based on certain metrics. And then finally, the way we've designed CityScore is that based on the roll-up score that we're giving a city, the weightings of the different factors are based upon that city, right? So a mayor of Shanghai could decide that libraries are a huge priority and want to weight that statistic of how many people are coming to that library three times over that of housing. That's definitely not the case in Boston, but that could happen elsewhere.
I want to chase that capitalist rabbit you just let out of the bag. I mean, there is something very, shall we say, neoliberal, marketizing, monetizing, corporatizing about this whole project, and it gives some people the willies.
Sure. Sure. Well, I think the point is that when we use it as a guide and not as an end-all be-all.
But once you have the number, you know, it's the number.
Absolutely. But at the end of the day, if we see that it's clear that we're not meeting our targets of the school buses that are arriving on time, if we have a target of 90% and we're getting 60%, I think most people would argue objectively that we should be using that number and we should be tracking that until it gets to 90%.
And at the same time, I got to say there's a worry here that reducing it to numbers or capturing the numbers takes the politics out of politics. This is exercise of power. The numbers would sort of sterilize it, as if to say, oh, I'm just looking at the numbers here.
I think we've seen from poll numbers and how quickly they shift that numbers really aren't everything, and it's the qualitative campaigning and the messaging that really works. So I think politics, the numbers will always be a part of it, but not everything.
Dan Coe is our guest. He's Marty Walsh's chief of staff. We're talking about the many numbers that would go into a single City Score. Coming up, we're going to invent some new metrics for what people really want in their city. This is Open Source. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source. We've got a data-driven mayor in Boston now in the power brokerage, used to be called a huck shop, known as City Hall. It is Chief of Staff Dan Coe's job to put a number on every job the city government does. But then also, the real task is to figure out a composite number that would approximate a measure of this city's or any city's health and happiness. Carl Williams, who's a staff lawyer at the American Civil Liberties Union, joins us. He's lived in Roxbury for two decades. On this all-important matter of which numbers go into the soup, Carl, a comment or two.
I think this is the beginning of something, of a great idea. And having open data, being transparent about that, those are things that I think people in the city and people in the country want. Those are things that are essential for democracy. I think there are some numbers that we could put in there. Recently, there have been stories, particularly about the police department.
Let's hear it.
One that I think is a dramatic one and also would be hard to juke the numbers on is homicide solved over number of homicides. And I think that would be a fairly dramatic number. It's a number that is out there. Seeing that on the open data portal, seeing that as a factor in here, also seeing police interactions with civilians with this
citizen. Let's call it stop and frisk. I want to know whether the city is going to release and be public about the numbers that the police obviously collect for themselves about calling people over or stopping them.
I think those numbers are seeing sort of what's happening nationally, also, you know, things that are happening, that things people are concerned about in Massachusetts and in Boston particularly. People have been marching, people have been protesting, and specifically knowing who stopped, who's frisked, who's searched, who's arrested, who's convicted. That package of information is something that I think people would like to see data on.
We'll come back to all of that, Carl Williams, but we've got lots more city wisdom in the queue. We've been asking people to name the one metric that you'd want in the mix.
My name's Jeff Speck. I'm a city planner based in Boston. I recently wrote a book called Walkable City. If we're talking about the successful city and what a city can measure, you know, CityStat and seeing how well your city performs in terms of the statistics that are typically measured is great for helping your city do a good job, you know, for government to do a good job. But if you want your city to be wealthy, healthy, green, you should be doing all that you can to provide alternatives to driving. That means principally investing in transit, biking, and walking. And we know that the more a city is car dependent, the more money leaves the local economy. They're spending it on cars and fuel rather than on housing and entertainment. We know the more a city is car dependent, the more time is wasted in commuting. You know, we know the more a city is car dependent, the greater commuting cost burden to the poor. The working poor spend 40% of their income on transportation. And the typical working class American spends more money on transportation than on housing, and that's because of the amount of driving we require them to do. You know, the more car dependent your city is, the more obese your citizens will be, the more asthma you'll have typically, the more car crashes, of course, that you'll have. The more car dependent your city is, of course, the more CO2 per capita by a long shot. And I should say, I was excited to read that Oslo is investing $500 million in bike infrastructure, and that's for a city of 600,000 people. And can you imagine what that would mean in American terms? And how can our cities compete with that?
That was Jeff Speck. Dan Coe, how do you measure car dependency?
Well, what's interesting, we're developing right now, and not to sound overly wonky, we're calling it a mobility index that has a factor of how walkable, bikeable, and livable the streets are in the city of Boston overall. A number of factors go into that. One of them is what we're calling Vision Zero, which is trying to limit the amount of pedestrian fatalities and incidents we have in the city. Car dependency, we're measuring everything from how many cars are flowing in the city, how the traffic is flowing, how it's being affected by bikes and pedestrians. And we're now, because of our partnership with a private sector organization called Waze that measures the speed of cars on your phone, actually, there are 450,000 users in the Boston area, we're able to measure how congestion works and how different experiments with car dependency can affect traffic.
Is there a clear trend up, down on car use?
So there is a lot of different conflicting studies on this, but with the advent of car sharing, the aspiration is to reduce the number of cars per capita by not by forcing people to be out of their cars, but because people see it as an inconvenience to have a car because they have options that make sense for them.
Here is a lawyer downtown who was a city councilor and who ran for mayor.
How are you? I'm Larry DiCara. I was a city councilor from 72 to 81. The fact that the city is collecting this data is laudable, but what they also need to remember is the human aspect between a person and their government. I think the best thing a politician can do is to be out there and to look people straight in the eye. Almost no one within a mile of St. Gregory's Church ever had a significant problem that didn't come to my attention, because if they didn't catch me, they'd find my parents at the Star Market, and those folks were very well served during the 10 years I was on the city council.
I'm sure they were, Larry. Here is a voter in East Boston.
I am Dr. Nina Estrella Luna. I'm a professor of law and policy at Northeastern University, and I am a resident, a homeowner in East Boston, in the Eagle Hill area of East Boston. I don't see any measures of the mix of affordable housing. There are no measures of the types of housing that are being developed or being redeveloped across the city. What I'm really concerned about is the loss of or potential loss of family and multi-generational housing. What makes neighborhoods stable and diverse are having ethnic diversity, age diversity, family status diversity, social status diversity, even employment diversity. The oversimplification of this complex thing that we call health and well-being of a city or a neighborhood is significantly more complex than what goes into making a baseball team successful in any one year.
React to that, Dan Coe, not just the baseball team thing, but I mean the measures of multi-generational housing.
So I'm glad you brought the housing thing up. As I mentioned, the mayor had a goal of 53,000 units by 2030. A lot of mayors like to make lofty statements about things far and away. But what we did, as I mentioned, is that we broke it down into those categories that she highlighted. And every week I get a report as to how we're trending towards those goals in 2030. So it's not just a high level, this is what we're going to do in 15 years. But every week, if I know that we're not building affordable housing at the rate that we're planning, I will know, and I will bring in the Department of Neighborhood Development, and I'll advise the mayor on how we can change course to make sure we are building that affordable housing.
Here is a voice from Cambridge.
My name is Catherine Tumber, and I am an urban researcher at the Dukakis Center at Northeastern University, and the author of a book called Small, Gritty, and Green, Sustainability in Smaller Industrial Cities. I really don't think you can reduce a city's well-being to metrics of any kind. But if one could arrive at something like a ratio of wages over cost of living on the neighborhood level tracked over time, and cost of living would include not just housing and transportation, which is standard, but health care and the costs associated with child care, you'd have a sense of the changes that have happened in different neighborhoods and the quality of life, at least economically, in those places.
That was Catherine Tumber. Here's an out-of-towner who's doing your job, Dan Coe, but as a freelancer.
My name is Jamie Calvin. I'm a writer and activist on the south side of Chicago. A metric that I would love to see measured on a sustained basis is police accountability, and I think it would be a very healthy sign to see a dramatic increase in the number of complaints, and coupled with that, a higher rate of sustained complaints. I think what a lot of institutions want to do is suggest that having very few complaints or very few allegations is a measure of success. I think, again, if we're being diagnostically realistic, then a really healthy sign would be a steady increase in complaints because people have greater confidence in the legitimacy of the institutions investigating their complaints.
Carl Williams of the ACLU, can you embrace that as a goal to get complaints about the police up?
I don't know if it should be up, down, or at the number that it is. Also, I don't know what the number is. But I think it should reflect what people feel about the police and incidences that are happening on our streets. That said, I think a number that's concrete is time to resolution, right? Someone files an internal affairs complaint. How long is that taking to resolve? And having some markers for that, I think, and markers for success is a crucial thing.
How open are the police records and this sort of thing, Dan?
So as Carl knows, when we looked at the stop and frisk, for example, we had found in our study of the police data that it took a long time to clean up, and even when it was cleaned up, the data was not reliable. So what we're trying to do now, and based on that report, is modernize that system. We have some stats that are now go on bpdnews.com that we release. I believe it's every week.
Like what?
Like part one crime, how that's changed, like homicides, carjackings, all those kind of things. As a matter of fact, there's this thing called CompStat where the police once a month all get together and talk about key metrics in their different areas. But obviously, there still needs to be a more formalized system that Commissioner Evans has spearheaded to modernize that data so we don't have the issues that we have in that last report.
Anything more, Carl?
I think that is moving in the right direction. If to see those, and I think the core one that people are asking for, they've been asking for New York and in Milwaukee and Chicago, as the voice in the radio just said, having that specific stop and frisk data and seeing it broken down by race, age, gender, and other categories, I think that data exists now. There is some cleaning up that definitely needs to be done, but that should be on the public portal.
Here is a model citizen that you, especially you, Dan, want to get to know.
My name is Shirley Kressel. I'm a landscape architect and urban designer. I live in the Back Bay on Hereford Street, and I care about the city. What we really see in Boston, that's the most important and persistent social and economic and environmental divide, is racial. It's an incredibly racially disparate and inequitable city. And that shows up in all of the indicators, all of the business indicators, the environmental indicators, the social, the educational, the infrastructure, everything. And I don't think that we can ever say that we are a prosperous city or a successful city when we don't have some, you know, real institutionalized program to equalize the playing field and to end that disparity. I mean, if I were mayor and I looked at all these indicators that people wiser than me have been looking at for 15 years, I would make that the first thing on my list that I would worry about. He doesn't have to worry about the knowledge economy and the innovation economy and how many square feet of building will Google occupy. All that stuff is going to take care of itself. You don't have to worry about the corporations. You have to worry about the impact of the corporations, the economic, the environmental, the political, the civic. That's part of the intensification of the racial disparity, which is even more persistent than the class disparity. And we all know that the city is just pricing itself out of range of working people. There's a cluster of very important problems that can be measured, but it's not going to be anything that people call in the 311 with their cell phone, you know, and say, please fix this racial inequality. We've fallen into a huge pothole. It's not a physical pothole. It's an existential pothole. It's a moral pothole. And we are not doing anything to fill that pothole, to dig ourselves out of it. If anything, we are measuring our success by things that deepen it and broaden it. We value what we can measure instead of the other way around. Or like somebody's mother used to say, we now know the price of everything and the value of nothing. Government is not baseball. It's not that simple. The goals of government are not that simple, and therefore the measurements of success are not that simple. The best measure of economic health is not how many millionaires you have in town. It's the diversity of the occupational base. That is what gives resiliency. So over time, whatever comes and goes and is hot and falls in and out of fashion, there's still a base left of all sorts of other makings and doings and manufacturings and ways to make a living. And that's not something I made up. I mean, diversity gives resiliency. That's true in nature, and it's true in society.
That was Shirley Kressel of the Back Bay. Dan Coe and Carl Williams, so much to chew on there. The existential and moral potholes that are part of a city, the racial separation and inequality that run through our city in particular. Where are we, Carl Williams? What are we doing about it?
I'm going to just steal the line that Shirley said, diversity breeds resiliency. One of the things I say about Boston very frequently when I'm outside of Boston is, if you sit down with a bunch of folks who really know the city, you could name any block and any either side of that block, and you could say who racially, ethnically lives there. And I think that there's nothing wrong with that. However, some things can happen. It's very easy to fall into these situations where policing and services and attitudes towards neighborhoods can start to fall by the wayside. And I think those things, and it sounds like in some ways that Dan is doing that work to mentioned before, to trace some of that information and to take a look at that, to visualize that on a map and to be able to look at it and say what's happening in these neighborhoods and what's happening in these sub blocks of these neighborhoods.
Dan, it's such an old knock on this city, and you wonder what's changing, what can be changed, what's a reasonable goal?
Well, a couple of things. I'm pleased that Shirley was talking about indicators, because having that data allows you to make informed decisions on how to address that data. So we're in agreement on that. I think the inequality issue is obviously one that's of huge concern to us. I think there's a number of different quantitative and qualitative reasons for that. I think for us, you got to look at what breeds inequality and how do we combat that. It's everything from creating more affordable housing. It's everything from having good education in our schools. It's not a one-stop cure-all, but it's improving all of those things at the same time, which I think is very important. On top of that, in the more qualitative way, the mayor has appointed a first-ever chief resiliency officer who's currently designing a series in which we will be having having conversations about the racial divides in the city. Obviously, just a conversation isn't going to solve everything, but getting different stakeholders in the room to just talk about Boston's racial history in a way that's never been done before, we think will be beneficial.
Explain that. What is a resiliency officer? How do you train for that? How did he get paid?
So it's actually a she. It's interesting. Dr. Atiyah Martin. It was originally going to be Bloomberg Philanthropies has grants they give to cities. Traditionally, resiliency refers to environmental resiliency. But we pitched and said that Boston has a history of racial issues. We want to put a resiliency officer to tell us how we become resilient from that, how we come from the history of the racial issues, and how we as a city move forward. And so we pitched that to Bloomberg. Bloomberg loved it and gave us a 3-year grant to fund a resiliency officer. And Dr. Martin has been spearheading that for the past few months. And we'll be having our first conversation around race in the beginning of next year. And we hope to bring together people from Dorchester and Southie and East Boston and Hyde Park to have these conversations in ways that we don't think has necessarily been done in such a public setting before.
Terrifically interesting caution going back to Shirley Kressel, but I loved it. She said we value what we measure because we know we can measure, but also because we don't measure what we value. How do you play with that sort of conundrum? The measurable becomes the factual and the real, and the immeasurable goes out the window.
I think you do it by two ways. I think first, the way we sequenced how we measure data in the city was that the mayor laid out his vision qualitatively with no metric first, right? And so that way we're creating those metrics to help inform and advance that qualitative agenda. And I think the second thing is just making sure that we're never forgetting that nothing will ever replace going out in the communities and talking with people.
Larry DeCaristown, within a mile of St. Gregory's Parish in Dorchester, they all know Larry.
I knew Larry would come up in this conversation somehow.
How are ya? I'm the mayor. We're trying to imagine a city score as simple as 98.6 to measure the temperature of our town. Coming up, the downside of progress in Kendall and Central Squares across the river in Cambridge, and second thoughts about the creative class with Richard Florida, who put a name on it. This is Open Source. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source. Taking the measure of our city with Mayor Marty Walsh's Chief of Staff, Dan Coe, who wants to get urban health and happiness into a 3-digit number. Carl Williams of the ACLU and I are second-guessing him. Just across the river in Central Square, Cambridge, the critic John Summers, who edits the stylishly contrarian Baffler magazine, is looking at the boom in building and jobs around MIT, and he's telling us you wouldn't want it in your neighborhood. John Summers, locate us. Here we are in dear old funky Central Square.
Vibrant.
Novartis, Pfizer, the drug companies of the world blossoming all over the place, a new Meridian Hotel where the Middle East, cheapo records, still survive somehow. What the hell is going on? And what are we looking at?
Well, off to the distance, we have Maya Lin's new building built for Novartis, which has come up very rapidly in the last year and a half. It looks like it's almost done. And we have a series of big, blocky buildings that stretch behind that toward Kendall Square, which seems to be taking up huge zone, technology park-type zones. And if you turn then to the left, you see the corridor of Massachusetts Avenue eventually ending down at the square, turning at the square at Harvard Square. And the question is, what's going to happen to cheapo records and some of the more funky places in the onrush of what they call vibrant neighborhood, which is the corporate coinage of the moment, to justify the essential ugliness and noise that they're surrounding us with?
It's rhythmic.
Why can't we get some quiet in Central Square?
It's music, John.
Jesus. It's music that's more appropriate to Manhattan than our little academic oasis of Cambridge.
John, 25 years ago, if somebody had said to the mayor of Cambridge, we're going to have global companies with an industry that serves the whole world, high-tech medical foundations, nothing but good jobs at good wages, as Mike Dukakis used to say, what in the world would you have thought was wrong with this?
Well, I think there was such a thing, wasn't it? The Route 128, the biotech corridor, which stretches back to the 70s.
And the cities were drained and looking for jobs. Isn't this better than that?
what's the difference, except for it's now it's right in our face instead of on a highway corridor. Now it comes back with much greater pretensions, not just to providing jobs, like you say, but also to kind of colonizing urban neighborhoods with a certain kind of aesthetic and a certain kind of feel. The industry, I mean, let's face it, is almost entirely male and almost entirely white or immigrant professional. It's not exactly a diverse workforce that they're putting down in the middle of our communities, which historically have been quite diverse, especially in Central Square, as you know. There's a homogenization going on, not only in terms of the economic model, because the only appropriate model now is something that flies under the label of innovation economy, but also in terms of social diversity. I haven't been here that long. I've been here for 15 years, but I've seen it before my eyes. Fewer and fewer people, the kind of people that attracted me to Central Square and to Cambridge in the first place, and more the same type of people, the same type of architecture, same type of rhetoric, politics. It's invaded the way we talk about social change, the way we talk about government. And one thing that is not often apparent is Silicon Valley has origins in Cambridge. There are very strong ties, as I'm sure you're aware of, between MIT and the development of Silicon Valley as a certain type of industry.
What is the thinking, the real thinking?
The kind of fetish for competition. You could talk about it in terms of some kind of effort to capture information about citizens and transform them into some kind of spectators. Make their life easy, install efficiency as the paramount value in life. The vision for politics is the government is an umpire. So they're neutral, right? I mean, this is an old idea, actually, in American history, that the government is not a stakeholder. It doesn't create markets, as in fact it does all the time, but that it is a neutral umpire. Mm. And here, with the rhetoric coming out of Boston City Hall, it's not a metaphor anymore. It's almost a reality. It's almost exactly what they want to do, is establish this kind of fake objectivity and pretend as if they're only making neutral decisions. All kinds of questions haven't even been asked. Who owns the data? It's easy to see where a politician would rather deal with a set of algorithms than a grumpy person in a town hall meeting, angry people, right? But just for that reason, we have to ask, what are people actually for in this? Or if only to generate data that can go in one direction.
What do the investors tell you, the Googles of the world, as well as Mark Zuckerberg, as well as the drug companies, as well as, I mean, all the dreamy new giant brand names are here. What does that tell you?
Dreamy? The significant part of the workforce in the innovation economy and the contributors to this kind of way of life don't belong to our community. They belong to corporate headquarters. And, you know, there's also a kind of safety in numbers on the part of the corporations. So you ask why we would want them. Why do they want to come here, right? They all want to come here for the same reason: educated workforce, compliant politicians, business-friendly social policies. But they've all sort of come at once, right? They've all sort of come in a big cluster. Clustering is the term that they use for these endless innovation hubs and labs and this horrible metaphor. You can't make anything in Cambridge anymore if you don't call it a lab. Well, the risk is that they'll all go at once. They'll all just go somewhere else when they get a better package deal.
That was the Baffler-in-Chief John Summers growling at the artsy, affluent, mobile 21st century talents that every mayor wants and that Cambridge and Boston have in spades, for now anyway. I put it to the urbanist Richard Florida, who coined the phrase creative class, what is to be done with those gifted people?
You have to kick them out. That's the solution. Kick them out and let Cambridge go back to what it was. No, I'm just kidding. That creative class has packed itself into places like Boston. The Greater Boston Metro has one of the highest concentrations on the planet. And Cambridge had an incredibly high percentage of this creative class around MIT, around Harvard, branching out from there, and of course, all of the tech startups. So I think the real challenge is we can't throw the proverbial baby out with the bathwater. We want to encourage creativity and innovation in our urban centers to thrive, but we also have to overcome this incredible vexing inequality. And I mean, MIT is a big, rich place. It should be building more housing for its people. I call them the new urban Luddites, you know, these NIMBYs who don't want density, who don't want more housing construction. You know, in a place like MIT and Harvard, these are big multi-billion dollar players. They should be helping to build more housing for their own creative class and perhaps to bolster their communities they're in.
How do we avoid that pattern shows up in in Mumbai years ago, these huge spikes of luxury housing settled in a deep slum. You see them in Brooklyn too, and we begin to see the possibility of them in Boston, a lot of other places, but a completely separate city of the rich and the gifted.
I mean, this is exactly what the book I'm working on deals with. I call it the new urban crisis. You know, it's no longer the old urban crisis of a hole in the donut and, you know, fiscal catastrophe. It's an urban crisis of, in part, success, of incredible affluence, you know. And it's not just inequality. I think we've riveted on inequality for good. But I think it's much more this separation of people between neighborhoods of haves and have-nots. And it's not simply that the people live in shining towers or wonderful townhouses close to the urban core, close to Harvard Square, close to wonderful neighborhoods in Boston or around transit. It's that their kids derive incredible benefits. And I think increasingly, if you don't have a rich parent and you don't have access to the bank of mom and dad, our research is finding you can't get into one of these neighborhoods. So we're reproducing and recreating the conditions of advantage and affluent, because the only people who can buy into the neighborhoods that have the vibrant job markets, the high-tech companies, the better opportunities for advancement are the people who already come from advantaged families. And that's the kind of class stratified society that Americans have always believed. You know, that might happen in India. That might happen in the United Kingdom. But it certainly didn't happen in America. But I think it's on our doorstep. So you're very right. My friends like to say mayors can do it all. Cities can solve their own problems. Yes, to a certain extent. But, I mean, we have fallen down so far with regard to federal urban policy. We don't have a federal urban policy. So this is going to require the federal government also saying we're going to have to get in and provide support for transit, provide support for better jobs, and provide support for more affordable housing.
What should be required, Richard Florida, of these companies, a lot of them foreign, like Novartis, but Google, Facebook, you name it, who come in and build the towers? There's a sense that local politicians and cities don't have the leverage they need to strike an honest bargain. For example, to get affordable housing built into the deal.
Well, I think mayors are struggling with this. You know, Bill de Blasio in New York is trying to do this. These people are making super profits. The profits on these urban buildings are astronomical. So maybe having them help pay for more affordable housing. One thing we know, you know, to live in a great city with a great job market, with a great technology economy, with good schools, people are willing to pay more. Massachusetts, it has been called Taxachusetts forever, and it still has one of the best and most booming tech economies on the planet. Same with California, same with New York. I guess what I'm saying is running a knowledge economy, an innovation economy, call it a blue state economy, is expensive. It requires investment in knowledge institutions, investments in transit, investments in open space, investments in affordable housing, which cost a lot of money.
What about public schools?
Absolutely. I mean,
quality public schools. And Cambridge has them.
Cambridge has them.
Boston doesn't.
I live at least part of the year in Toronto, and we have great public schools. And the advantage is that Toronto never lost its urban middle class. But, you know, a place like Boston, what you see then is a barbell demography. You see the affluent people and the young people and the empty nesters and the few, the privileged few who can provide, can afford private schools. And then everyone else who can't is pushed out to the suburbs where they can access a public school system. And that, Jane Jacobs, my great mentor, the great urbanist, always said, the key to having a great innovative city is diversity, diversity of people, diversity of companies, diversity of ages, diversity of ethnicities and races and classes. And I worry that our great cities, I mean, we're not there yet, and we have a long way to go on this, but maybe San Francisco and London are out on the extreme with this, are becoming much more homogeneous, the young, the affluent, and the privileged, the global plutocrats. And that may actually not only make the city more segmented, it may make the city less innovative and creative in the long run. And that's quite a worry.
Richard, our guest Dan Coe from Boston City Hall has been tweaking a city score, and it's just well begun, but to encompass every kind of statistical measure that would make a composite health rating, a number that would tell you how you're doing. Do you believe in such things? Can you imagine a city score of your own?
I think evidence-based, data-based management in general is a good thing. You know, corporations and the great corporations, the Toyotas of the world, if you will, have been at this for a while. And what those corporations learned is it's not just having data at the top levels. It's really letting the workers on the factory floor, have access to statistical data, analytical data, tweak their own processes. And clearly, Boston is way out in front, and Dan and the mayor have done fantastic things that other cities are trying to emulate. But I think the real key to this will be moving that kind of data down to the neighborhood level and empowering neighborhoods and communities to use that data to solve their own problems, especially in a big, complex city like Boston.
That was Richard Florida. Carl Williams and Dan Coe, so many questions, little time. But first, Dan, where is the federal government these days?
Well, I think we're seeing a very concerning decrease in funding from the federal government in terms of how we can deal with the housing crisis in the city. So I think it's important for us to have a very robust housing plan at the city level because, quite frankly, we can't count on the federal funding that used to be there for our strategy.
The big burden, Carl, seems to me to be affordable housing and this kind of ingrained history of inequality. Where's to begin again?
I think one of the core things, it was said there and it's said at the top of the show, is open source, right? All of...
We love open source.
And a term invented in MIT, really talking about the code that makes up a program, right? And for a city and for a democracy, that's the data. It's where the money's being spent, what's being repaired, what's being done. It's the stuff that Dan is doing. Having that real core data, the good, the bad, and the ugly pieces of all of that available to people and some parts visualized is essential for us to have a strong democracy in our city and in our country. So I think that work is being done. I think some more needs to be done to have an open and transparent city government.
I keep hearing a lot of different things here, but the main threads, first, the crux of Richard Florida's idea that the creative class, for all its glitter and gold, is driving up standards of living and opportunities and diversity, but mainly for itself. The rest of us are, well, some of us certainly, well, it's a hard time to live in a city. But the other thing I've just got to say, Dan, I my strongest push on the numbers would be to open it wide up, have charrettes in every neighborhood. You could literally, you know, farm it out. $1,000 a portfolio of interesting numbers that we ought to be looking at. What's possible?
Absolutely. Anything's on the table at this point. The one thing I want to point out from that conversation that I would respectfully disagree with is the umpire analogy. We're definitely not objective. We have an agenda. We have an agenda around affordable housing and inequality. These are the things that the data empowers us to make better decisions to push that agenda. And the question of who owns the data, it's the people's data. And everything that we're doing with CityScore is open to the public.
Who owns it, by the way?
The people own the data.
Okay. Consider some numbers as we wind up. Boston, 21st most populous city in the country, number one for innovation, number one for energy efficiency, number one for arts organizations per capita. We're number two for car-free commuters, number three for parks, fourth largest transit system, fifth most educated workforce, sixth healthiest, but we're also the third most unequal metropolitan area in America, after San Francisco and Atlanta. Cost of living 28% higher than the national average. Real income declining 4% since 1990. Housing costs have risen 55%. How do we deal with glorious news for most cities, but a stark problem right there in the middle?
There's so many factors that go into those numbers, and it's top of mind for the mayor every single day. I think there's no real single answer. I think, as I said, it comes down to everything from education to affordable housing. And the big people like the Googles and Facebooks, the mayor's announced that we're going to be increasing the linkage and inclusionary development policy rates for those developers for more affordable housing. Because, yes, it's attractive for us to have Googles and the Facebooks here, but it's very attractive for those companies to come to Boston and have access to that talent. And we need to realize that is leverage that we have.
How about those drug companies? 20 years ago or more, the late, great Jean Mayer, president of Tufts University, had a big dream of going to bring those European drug companies, the ones that aren't in Philadelphia, to Boston. We're going to build them over the South Station air rights. And suddenly, here they are. Yeah.
but it's a big concern to make sure that the jobs that are being created are good jobs. They're jobs not just for the most fortunate, but there are jobs all across the spectrum, and that those people see themselves as citizens of the community.
Last word, Carl Williams, a short one.
I think we're on the way. I think there's showing some parts of things that the city might not be so proud of are things that will make people trust the city government and want to build with it.
They'll make them read the Book of Numbers, too. Thank you, Carl Williams and Dan Coe. Thanks also to John Summers, Richard Florida, and our Committee of Concerned Citizens. We're going out on Winter Afternoon by BU in Boston by Jonathan Richman. Our show this week was produced by Pat Tomeno, Max Larkin, Connor Gillies, and Zach Goldhammer, with help from Azan and Azalea Reed. George Hicks is our engineer. Mary McGrath is our chief innovation officer. I'm Christopher Lydon. Join us next time on Open Source.